Oh, yeah, I got to email you the lecture notes. Okay. Okay, good morning, everybody. This is October 29th, Human Anatomy, and we're going to finish up Central Nervous System. Just a couple topics we have to look at in the Central Nervous System. And you took the third test last time, so we got two more tests. I think next week you have a practicum on nervous system, maybe on senses, and you might be already going into the heart in lab. I'm not quite sure where you are in lab, but don't forget you got a practicum next week. So that's kind of how we try to set the class up, so you don't have practicums and tests on the same week, so you can really focus. Some students did spectacularly well on the last test, and other students, you know, they got in the 30s or something, and so it's particularly sad to see that because it looked like you kind of just gave up on the class or something, all right? So if you get in there, to me, it kind of looks like you're not studying at all. But anyway, if you studied really hard and you didn't get the grade you want, then you got to come and see me to improve your grade, right? So even if you got in the low 90s and you want to get 100%, come talk to me and see how you can boost your grade up. Or if you got in the 80s and you want to get into the 90s, or if you got in the 60s and you want to get your grade up into the 80s or whatever, we can go over, look at your scantrons, see where you might be making your mistakes. And it's always a good idea to look at your scantrons to see what kind of mistakes you're making. Because don't forget, there's going to be a lot of tests in your lifetime that you're going to take where you fill in scantrons and you never get them back to see what kind of mistakes you're making. So you might be surprised that you actually think you're filling in a particular line a certain way, but for whatever reason you don't fill in the right bubbles. And that happens to good students. So come take a look at your scantron and see what kind of mistakes you're making. That way you get to review and see how I ask questions on the test, right? So you can learn a lot from looking at scantrons. So congratulations if you did really good on this test, because I know it's not an easy class. You have to put your time in to get good grades in here. So anyway, take advantage of your lab instructors and lecture instructors and even Dr. Sanchez. I'm sure he'd be really happy to talk to you if you have questions, right, if I'm not available. Okay. All right, so central nervous system. Anybody have any questions on central nervous system? So I'll ask a couple questions. What are the two main parts of the central nervous system? Brain and spinal cord, right? And a nice way to appreciate that those two parts are indeed central nervous system, because both the brain and spinal cord are surrounded by special membranes that protect the brain and the spinal cord as a unit, because the central nervous system doesn't have any bones in it or muscles holding it together. It's only the wrapping on the outside that protects the central nervous system. And nervous tissue, by its nature, okay, is very soft and it damages very easily. So it needs some special protective features besides just the cranium and the vertebral column. And that protective system is what we call the meninges. You know what I wanted to do first, though? I wanted to review something on reflexes before we get to meninges. So let's just go back real quick. Make sure you know these parts of the reflex and in what order they're in, right? So that should make sense. But, of course, I left two things off of the reflexes. What does a reflex always start with? A stimulus, right? And in order for your body to appreciate a stimulus, you have to have a receptor for that stimulus, and then that, right? So there's a sensory receptor, and the only way that can get to the central nervous system is via a sensory neuron. And to get into the central nervous system, it's got to go into the dorsal root of the spinal cord, passing the dorsal root ganglia. And inside the central nervous system, there are neurons that are completely contained within the central nervous system that analyze that data, compare the data to what your body should be functioning at. For instance, if this was a thermal receptor or temperature receptor, it's going to compare the temperature of your body with what number? Yeah, 98.6, 98.7. That number is in your central nervous system, and it's the association neurons that compare your body temperature to what it should be, and it makes a decision on what to do. For instance, if your body temperature is too high, what are these association neurons going to decide to do? They're going to make you sweat, right? So you're going to release heat to the environment, bring your temperature back down to normal. So association neurons make decisions. They store information what the normal value should be in your body, and then they tell the rest of your body what to do to get back to normal. So it sends information out of this central nervous system. The only way out of the central nervous system through a spinal nerve is through the ventral root. Through a motor neuron, that means what? That's going to be an efferent neuron, to an effector organ. And this effector organ in this particular case would be a sweat gland. And the effector organ is going to tell that sweat gland to produce sweat, which decreases your body temperature. That's going to be the response, right? So the response is always the last thing. All right, so I wanted to go over that really quick. All right, the meninges, going back to the membrane system around the brain, has three main layers to it. One is a really tough layer, one is sort of intermediate, and the third layer is a very delicate layer. Right? And the toughest layer is the most superficial, and it's like leather. It's even tougher than leather. If you tried to cut it in lab, I would guess we don't even have any scissors that are sharp enough to cut it in lab. You probably have to even bring in your own scalpel if you tried to cut the meninges on that sheep brain, okay? And that's what we call the dura mater. That's the most exterior. The next deepest is the arachnoid. That's an intermediate strength. And this layer right here has a space underneath it that we call the subarachnoid space. The subarachnoid space is filled with cerebrospinal fluid. And there's some parts deep inside the brain that make cerebrospinal fluid that flows through some spaces inside the brain, and we're going to look at that almost in the next slide. And then the most delicate layer is the pia mater, and this is the deepest as well as the most delicate. It follows every little nook and cranny and curvature and convolution of the brain. It lies right on the surface of the brain. All right, so the subarachnoid space is between the arachnoid and the pia mater. So let's take a look at this exam figure right here. And this is a pretty classical figure of a cross-section of the brain, so we're going to look right on midline. And so here we see cortical gray matter, and here we see white matter in the cerebral hemispheres. And the meninges, that lines, or is lying right on the cerebral cortex, all right, this is the deepest layer. What's the name of this one right here? This is the delicate layer, that's the pia mater. Right, and then we have a space between the arachnoid and the pia, and you can see it even has some connective tissue right here, some collagen fibers that are connecting these two layers. But in this layer here, we have cerebrospinal fluid, CSF. And we also have blood vessels in this layer. Notice in the brain, we don't have many large blood vessels at all. Okay, don't have many large blood vessels. They're in the subarachnoid space. All right, so that's pia mater, arachnoid, and then the next layer is what? The durable layer, the dura mater. So here is the dura mater, and the dura mater has two divisions. The most superficial one is right up against the surface of the cranial bone, so this is what we call the periosteal layer. We don't want to call it endosteal because endosteal is where? Inside of a bone. This is still on the outside of a bone, so it's really the periosteum, but it is lining the brain, so it's certainly a part of the dura mater, but it is the periosteal division. And then the deep one right here is what we call the meningeal layer of the dura mater. And these two form together and make a really tough membrane over the brain. All right, but the periosteal and the meningeal layer does have separations in it. So sometimes it does separate, and it forms a sinus. So here we have the superior sagittal sinus. And in this particular case, all right, when you think of sinus, you have to realize what is filling that space. So for instance, the paranasal sinuses have what in them? Okay, like lymphatic tissue and air that makes up your, there's spaces in the sphenoid bone, right, the maxilla, frontal bone, help fight infection, right? But in this particular case, this sinus doesn't have air, doesn't have lymphatic tissue. It is acting as a major blood vessel, a major vein that is draining blood from the brain back to the circulation. So the superior sagittal sinus is filled with blood going back to the heart, not air, right? So you got to be careful with that term sinus. Just like nucleus, you have to be careful of sometimes, because you could be talking about an atom, or you could be talking about a cell, or you could be talking about gray matter deep inside the brain. So from the context, you have to know what we're talking about, right? So sinus in the brain doesn't have air. It has venous blood going back to the heart. Okay. All right, and the cerebral spinal fluid sometimes can be considered a lot like blood, but it shouldn't have red blood cells. It shouldn't have a lot of white blood cells in it. It should only have the fluid part of blood. The fluid part of blood is what we call plasma. So cerebrospinal fluid is a lot like plasma, and actually it comes from blood. We're going to see where it comes from in just a second. And it's returned back to the blood so that we don't dehydrate. So cerebrospinal fluid is returned back to the normal circulation through this arachnoid villus right here. So CSF will drain back into, for instance, the superior sagittal sinus and be returned to your cardiovascular system.
It protects the brain too, doesn't it?
Oh, the meninges right here?
No,
or this villus?
Cerebrospinal fluid
nourishes the brain and protects the brain as well.
Okay.
So for instance, back when people started playing football, they didn't wear shoulder pads, they didn't wear helmets, and they would just crash into each other. Guess what happened? A lot of people got hurt, right? So that's terrible to run into somebody and just crash heads. So somebody had a bright idea, well, let's wear a helmet. So they made a helmet, and what were the first helmets like?
Leather.
They were leather. Yeah, I don't know if I still have mine, but it was just leather. Okay. Well, if you just were like wearing a leather glove and you crash into somebody, you can imagine what it felt like. How would it feel? Well, it would hurt, right? It would hurt really bad. So somebody else had a really good idea. Instead of making it out of leather, let's make it out of plastic, which is what? Kind of hard. It can deflect a lot of trauma, distribute the force around the head, prevent brain injuries and things like that. So that was a major improvement. But if you ever look at a football helmet today, it's even more sophisticated. It's got the hard shell, but if you look on the inside, what does it have? Okay, it's not just padding. There's padding inside to absorb the shock, but now there's even chambers inside a helmet. And some of the chambers have air, and some of the chambers have fluid. All right, so I think actually somebody was studying the meninges and decided to make a helmet that actually is modeled after the meninges. So the pockets that have air are pumped up after somebody puts it on so the helmet fits their head just right, but the fluid inside those chambers absorbs shock and distributes the shock around the skull so that the head doesn't have to absorb the shock. Right? So these fluid-filled chambers inside of a helmet protect what's inside of it from trauma. The same thing for the meninges. Right? So for instance, if you get a blow to the side of the head, this fluid helps suspend the brain and distribute the shock all the way around the brain so that the brain doesn't rip. It's actually pretty ingenious how evolution has figured that out. Okay, so one of the main purpose of the meninges is to protect the brain, right, from head trauma. And that usually does a pretty good job. Okay, but don't forget, this arachnoid villus is how that cerebral spinal fluid is returned to the circulation. And there really aren't very many places in the body where you have a fluid-filled compartment that is stationary, that is not moving. Right? So this cerebral spinal fluid is not just sitting there, right? It is flowing. It is moving around your brain, redistributing nutrients and ions in various places. Okay. I do want to talk about a couple other special parts of the dura, and that's the falx cerebri and the tentorium. So these are parts of the dura mater that separate the right and left cerebral hemispheres. That would be the falx cerebri, and the tentorium separates the occipital lobe from the cerebellum. So hopefully you can kind of have a picture of where those things are in your mind, but let's take a look at these. All right, so here's that superior sagittal sinus filled with blood, right? And the longitudinal fissure is separating the cerebral hemispheres. And so that space is filled with the falx cerebri. And here's the cerebellum. here's the occipital lobe. And we have a transverse sinus in this region here as well, taking blood back to the jugular vein, which is going to take it back to the heart. But there is part of the dura mater in this region as well, and that's what we call the tentorium. All right, so here we can see the falx cerebri. Now we're right on midline, right mid-sagittal section, separating the cerebral hemispheres. And here's that superior sagittal sinus again. And this is part of the dura mater that is separating the occipital lobes in this region from the cerebellum that would be down in this region right here. Okay, so it's separating the major parts of the brain. And furthermore, here you can, if you remember back, flash back to your bones, here is the falx cerebri attaching to the crista galli of the ethmoid bone, and it just shows why that ethmoid bone is so cool, because it's what? It's holding on to the falx cerebri and the rest of the dura mater so that your brain isn't sloshing around inside your cranial vault. So that ethmoid bone is performing a lot of really marvelous functions as well, and it has the paranasal sinuses too that fight infection, but we went over all that already. Okay, so falx cerebri, the dura mater separating the cerebral hemispheres, the tentorium separating the cerebellum from the occipital lobe. Okay, well, let's now turn our attention to the cerebral spinal fluid. So it is fluid, should not contain cells, should not contain what we call formed elements like red blood cells, white blood cells. And if those components are in cerebral spinal fluid, that's a sign of some kind of trauma to the brain, maybe a stroke or infection, because that's the job of white blood cells to fight infection. So if they're in cerebral spinal fluid, they're there for a reason, trying to fight infection, and you shouldn't have an infection in the brain. We call that encephalitis, very dangerous. And it can be lethal in just a matter of hours if not treated, diagnosed and treated properly. Okay, so the tissue that actually synthesizes cerebral spinal fluid is what we call the choroid plexus. It produces about 500 milliliters per day. How much is that? What is this bottle right here? This bottle right here is 500 mLs. So the choroid plexus actually produces this much fluid every day in your brain. And obviously then, that fluid has to leave the brain, otherwise what would happen to your head every day? It would get bigger by 500 mLs, by the size of this bottle. All right, so that can't happen. It does in some people. All right, and we have to treat those people with hydrocephalus when they have a buildup of fluid in their brain. It happens during development. Okay. So how does that cerebral spinal fluid get returned to your cardiovascular system? Okay, it goes back to the circulatory system. How does it get from that subarachnoid space back into your circulatory system? There was a structure that I showed you on the previous slide that takes these 500 milliliters a day, returns it to your circulatory system so that your head doesn't swell up, and more importantly, so that you don't dehydrate. Right? If you lose fluid from your cardiovascular system, that's very deadly as well. We call that dehydration. How does that fluid get back? That's through that. Let's go back to that slide. That goes through this arachnoid villus right here. Okay, is it labeled on your slide that way? Yeah, arachnoid villus. All right, so that's how cerebral spinal fluid gets back. It's easy to miss that little part of the diagram, so I kind of emphasized it again. Okay. All right, so the tissue that makes cerebral spinal fluid is the choroid plexus, and the choroid plexus is a combination of a couple different tissues. It's part ependymal cells, and that could be on the next test because I ask you to know the different kinds of neuroglia, support cells in the nervous system. Ependymal cells are not neurons, but they're nervous tissue. They line all the cavities inside the brain, which we're going to look at the ventricles, right? And these ependymal cells in a few places in the brain are highly vascular. So here you see a capillary, and this capillary is donating oxygen, vitamins, various ions that are necessary for neuronal function, and glucose, which is an energy molecule. So cerebral spinal fluid bathes the brain with all of these important kinds of nutrients, but it also takes away waste products. So this right here, the choroid plexus produces CSF, nourishing the brain, but it also removes waste products from the brain, including CO2. Okay, so that's the choroid plexus. And the places where we have choroid plexus are not numerous, only a couple locations. There's one location in the ventricles, which are the deep cavities inside the brain within the cerebral hemispheres. So we can't really see the lateral ventricles on this slide because this is just a sagittal section. All right, but the choroid plexus nonetheless is in the lateral ventricles. There's also another segment in the roof of the third ventricle. So this part of the brain right on midline is the third ventricle, kind of in the very center around the thalamus and inside the hypothalamus. So here's the hypothalamus and here's the thalamus. So these tissues are supplying cerebrospinal fluid to the ventricles. And the third place where we have choroid plexus is here in the fourth ventricle. All right, and that cerebrospinal fluid, since it's being produced in these areas right here, right, there is going to be flow established. So CSF flows from the lateral ventricles into the third, from the third ventricle into the fourth ventricle, and there is a little pathway right here that allows CSF to flow through it. This is what we call the aqueduct of Sylvius, or sometimes the cerebral aqueduct. And this is really a small, narrow space, right? And there is just a tremendous amount of flow through this little tiny, you could even think of this as like a vessel, but it's not. It's just a little passageway within the brain. CSF just squirts through here very rapidly into the fourth ventricle. And from the fourth ventricle, it can go into the central canal of the spinal cord, or it can leave through this aperture into the subarachnoid space. Right? If it gets into the central canal, it goes all the way to the conus medullaris of the spinal cord, where it leaves the central canal into the subarachnoid space, because remember, the meninges completely surrounds the spinal cord as well as the brain. So it leaves, goes into the subarachnoid space, and then once it's in the subarachnoid space, it ascends up the spinal cord through the subarachnoid space and eventually reaching an arachnoid villus, and then it's reabsorbed into the superior sagittal sinus, returning it to the circulatory system. So the CSF belongs to its own little circulatory system within the brain, okay, starting in the ventricles, going through the central canal, subarachnoid space, and then being returned to your cardiovascular system. So that's the CSF. Okay. So it produces 500 mLs a day. The total volume is only about 100 mLs. So that just means that your cerebrospinal fluid turns over, five times every day. So that's a pretty good flow volume, and it's produced by these ependymal cells that make up the choroid plexus. All right, so here is just a list of how CSF flows through the brain. Okay. And for instance, if there is a blockage in the cerebral aqueduct, or if there is a blockage in the foramen between the lateral ventricles and the third ventricle right here, then that choroid plexus is going to keep producing CSF, and it's going to fill the skull up with cerebrospinal fluid, compress the neuronal tissue, which is going to produce neuronal deficits, all right, and that's the condition that we call hydrocephalus. Next slide, this button here. So here is a newborn with hydrocephalus that wasn't diagnosed, all right, prenatally, and was born with this disorder. Okay, today with ultrasound, it's very easy to diagnose individuals with this condition. And if there is a blockage of the, if there's a blockage of the aqueduct of Sylvius or the interventricular foramen right here, then that can actually be, that can be reduced, or a shunt can be placed even before the infant is born. So surgery, this kind of brain surgery can be done in utero, preventing any kind of neuronal damage. So that's actually pretty cool. Yeah.
But you know, they put that shunt right where that arachnoid villus is, or put into that area?
Case-by-case determination. I wouldn't be surprised even if it's put into a subclavian vein.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. So depending on where the blockage is.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's always, and those techniques probably are changing. I don't know if what we're doing today is what we're going to be doing 10 or 15 years from now. Don't really know for sure. All right, so I think that is it for central nervous system. Okay. All right, so we can close that down. We can close this down. And move on to chapter 14. Okay, so this is probably a pretty good idea to look at that flow diagram that I gave you right at the very beginning of the nervous system that broke your nervous system down into what? Central and peripheral. Central into spinal cord and brain. Peripheral into, I think it was motor and sensory. Okay? And so this is a similar diagram to what I gave you. And the motor division or efferent division can be broken down into somatic versus visceral. So somatic is just another name for voluntary in this sense. So what part of your body do you have voluntary control over? Skeletal muscle, and that's the only other thing, right? The visceral motor just means autonomic. Parts of your body that you don't have control over, which is most everything else, in particular the heart, smooth muscle, and glands. Right, so we should see that over here in this area right here. Yeah, smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, glands. Okay, innervated by the autonomic nervous system. And then the last chapter in the nervous system that we're going to look at, next week, is the autonomic nervous system. And the autonomic nervous system can be broken down into two divisions, the sympathetic and parasympathetic. All right, so today we're just going to look at the peripheral nervous system, which is everything outside of the central nervous system. Okay, yeah, yeah.
Hearing as somatic.
I want to make a little distinction when we get to senses. All right, I want to make a distinction between general senses and special senses. Okay, and why don't we just wait until we get to senses, okay? And I will straighten out that confusion a little bit. Okay, but if you hear somatic, what should you automatically be thinking about? Somatic should mean voluntary. Okay, so for motor, it means to skeletal muscles. But in terms of sensation, when you say somatic, it should be on the surface of your body, so your skin, right, or in muscles, your limbs. As opposed to visceral, visceral will be coming from a body cavity someplace. So, yeah, stomach is in your abdominal cavity, heart is in your thoracic cavity or pericardial cavity. You would want to say visceral as opposed to somatic. So there's a little bit of confusion maybe with this somatic versus visceral. Okay. So I'll simplify it when we get to senses. Okay, so here we have sensory receptors, and since this is in your skin, this is going to be somatic sensation. And as a matter of fact, since you have these sensors in your skin, like for instance, if I were to take an ice cube and put it on your earlobe, could you tell it was cold? Yeah. Your nose? What about your back? Yeah. Your kneecap? Yeah. All right, so temperature is what I call a general sensation because you have temperature receptors all over your body. Right, no matter where I put that ice cube on the surface of your skin, you're going to tell me, oh, it's hot, it's cold, or I can feel a pin or not a pin. So pain is a general sensation. Right, and this particular case, it would also be somatic because it's on the surface of the skin. So in order to perceive these sensations, you need what? A sensory nerve fiber. And this is not in the central nervous system. Here, this is the cell body of that unipolar neuron in the dorsal root ganglia. Don't forget, a ganglia is just a accumulation of nerve cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system someplace, and this is still peripheral nervous system. Sensory information always goes in the dorsal root. We've looked at spinal cord already, I believe, right? So here's the dorsal root. entering the central nervous system, in particular, the dorsal horns of the gray matter, where there's a synapse here, we can see some association neurons. And then in the anterior horn, we have cell bodies of motor neurons. And efferent signals always leave via motor neuron via the ventral root. And this right here is what we call the spinal nerve. So spinal nerve is always going to be mixed. It has afferent as well as efferent axons in it. Okay, and that's going to go to some effector organ. Okay, and that's the purpose of this slide, just to show you this overall architecture of some peripheral nerves at the level of the spinal cord. Now, there can be other motor neurons that go to your body that don't leave the spinal cord. So where can some other motor neurons leave your central nervous system if it's not spinal cord? What's another part of your central nervous system? Your brain, right? So there are actually nerves that leave the brain, and we don't call those spinal nerves, we call those cranial nerves. All right, so this would be a spinal nerve because it's leaving the spinal cord right here. Okay. All right, so different kinds of receptors that we have in the peripheral nervous system. These are all general senses as well as somatic because they're on the surface of the skin. We have some deep receptors in the skin. These are what we call Pacinian corpuscles. These are for deep kind of pressure and vibration. We have free nerve endings around hair follicles. And so when somebody brushes up your skin, disturbs a hair follicle, you can feel that. We have others like these Merkel's discs. This is for a very light touch because they're very superficial. And over here is a Meissner's corpuscle. Again, because this is very superficial, this is for light touch. And Ruffini's corpuscle down over here, this is deeper in the dermis, so what would you guess this is for, a very light touch or a deeper sense of pressure and vibration?
Deeper.
Yeah, deeper, because it's deeper down in the dermis. Okay. Free nerve endings are responsible for pain as well as temperature. So pain and temperature come from free nerve endings. Okay, so functional organization. Sensory, peripheral nervous system, very good. Sensory means what? The signals are going to go from the periphery to the central nervous system. Somatic division comes from the skin, body wall, which is musculature, as well as limbs. Visceral division is from body cavities, visceral organs that you have in body cavities, back to the central nervous system. Okay, and the motor I think you're familiar with already. We talked about that. Okay, so in terms of structural organization, we have receptors in the periphery. We just looked at a number of receptors for touch and for pain and for temperature. We have peripheral motor endings that would be the neuromuscular junction for controlling skeletal muscle. And so the two ways that signals can leave or enter the central nervous system, either from the spinal cord, we would call those spinal nerves, but if they leave the brain, those are cranial nerves. And you got to know that there are 12 pairs of cranial nerves. They arise from the brain. So that includes the pons and the medulla. For instance, and the spinal nerves, there are 31 pairs that arise from along the spinal cord. Okay, all right, so peripheral receptors, this is what we were talking about, free nerve endings. There are some receptors that can measure things on the outside world. We call those exteroreceptors, like temperature in the environment, for instance, pressure that's applied to your body. So we call those exteroreceptors for touch, pressure, pain, temperature, right? And most special sense organs are exteroreceptors, like vision, because you don't want to see light inside your body. You want to see light outside your body, so those are exteroreceptors. Interoceptors, on the other hand, tell you something about what's happening inside your body. For instance, if you have an appendicitis, you're going to feel that pain. That would be a visceral pain. And that's going to have a different kind of sensation than a pain receptor on the surface of your body, a somatic pain. So if you get poked with a pin on the surface of your body, it's going to be a very sharp, acute pain. And you can localize where that pain is coming from. But if it's a visceral pain from deep inside your body, all right, it's not acute. It's very dull. But that doesn't mean that it's any less obnoxious or painful. It just means that it has a different effect in your body. Right? A deep visceral pain can be just as or more uncomfortable. So for instance, if you've ever had a kidney stone, for instance, it might be debilitating. It's just not going to be a sharp, localized pain. It's going to be a very dull pain that you can't really localize to one part of your body, but it still might be debilitating. You still might not be able to function, even with that kind of pain. Okay, and another kind of receptor is what we call a proprioceptor. Proprioceptors are located in skeletal muscles. They're located in joint capsules, tendons, and ligaments. And they give your body your sense of body position and whether muscles have the appropriate tension. So for instance, if I ask somebody to hold this bottle right here that's filled with water, you can grab it and hold on to it, right? But if I were to give somebody a bottle maybe as big as this roll of paper towels, but instead of having water in there, I had lead, right? And I asked somebody to hold it with one hand, guess what would happen? Okay, it would be too heavy to hold, and the muscles would know that that weight is way too heavy, and the muscles would relax and you would drop the weight. Okay, so there are sensors in muscles that know when they're being overloaded. Those are what we call proprioceptors. Right, proprioceptors are also in joint capsules, so even with your eyes closed, for instance, if I were to take somebody's hand or arm with their eyes closed and put their hand above their head like this, I could say, all right, where's your right hand? And you could say, oh, my right hand is above my head. My left hand is down by my side. So even without looking, you could tell where your body is. That's due to proprioceptors. So where do you have proprioceptors? In one or two locations in your body or all over your body? All over. So because of that, proprioception or proprioceptors are what we call a general sense. It's a general sense, just like pain, touch, pressure, all right? But other senses are what we call special senses because you can't perceive these senses all over your body. And those we'll look at in the sense chapter. What's the kind of perception that you can only appreciate in one or two areas in your body? Taste on your tongue. That's a special sense. Hearing only with your ears. That's special because it's a limited location. Right? You can't hear with your belly button. Can't hear with your kneecap. Okay. Smell. Only your nose. Can't smell with your earlobe. And, of course, eyes for vision. That's a special sense. All right, so if I shine a flashlight on your kneecap, you couldn't see it, right? It has to be your eyes. So that's a special sense. Okay, we can also classify receptors by what kind of modality of energy that they respond to. Mechanoreceptors respond to touch and pressure, vibration, and hearing is a result of a mechanoreceptor because sound is a mechanical wave being transmitted through air. And if there's not a medium like air, sound can't get through it. Like in outer space, there's no medium for any kind of energy to be transmitted, a mechanical wave, so outer space is completely silent. Thermal receptors respond to? Yeah, heat, temperature, heat or temperature, cold. Chemoreceptors are receptors that respond to chemicals, like molecules, and there are some very important molecules inside your body. Who could maybe think of a very important molecule inside your body that your body might like to really know what the concentration is?
Glucose.
Okay, glucose, for instance, that's the molecule that's going to make ATP, right? So that's how your body monitors energy, is from glucose, not necessarily from ATP. So there are glucose receptors. And there's an organ that has glucose receptors in the pancreas, and when the pancreas misbehaves, that produces a disease state where somebody can't regulate their blood glucose. So some of you might be familiar with that. That's called diabetes mellitus, for instance, right? So that would be a chemoreceptor. Another kind of important chemoreceptor measures the acidity of your body or the pH of your body all the time so that you can make adjustments. Those would be due to chemoreceptors. Photoreceptors, where do we have those? In your eyes. It's a special sense. Only your eyes have photoreceptors. They measure light or photons, a little packet of light energy. And nociceptors, not sure you're familiar with that term, but these receptors monitor tissue damage. And that could be due to burning or poking or ripping or any kind of trauma to your body. So these really are what? Pain receptors. So nocistimulus would be some kind of stimulus that's going to produce tissue damage. And of course, that's very important to know, because if a certain part of your body is being damaged, you want to experience that so you can remove your body from that damaging stimulus. Okay. All right, so other kinds of receptors are encapsulated, like the Meissner's and Pacini and Ruffini's corpuscles. Some are deep in the dermis, some are more superficial, like the Meissner's, that's there for light pressure, very small deformations of the dermis. Non-encapsulated, like the free nerve endings, the Merkel's discs, and receptors in hair follicles are non-encapsulated. And then here are the proprioceptors that we talked about, the three different kinds. The muscle spindles are in muscle that measure stretch. If you overstretch a muscle, it's going to cause that muscle to contract. Golgi tendon organs measure tendon stretch, and joint kinesthetic receptors and joint capsules for measuring body position. Okay. All right, so in terms of peripheral motor endings, these innervate skeletal muscle. And the junction between a skeletal muscle and a neuron, or maybe more appropriately, it's best to say a motor neuron and a skeletal muscle, because the information comes from the motor neuron to the skeletal muscle, causing it to contract, is what we call the neuromuscular junction. And sometimes we actually call that the motor end plate underneath the motor neuromuscular junction. These have a similar structure to a synapse, with some slight modification. So let me see if I can find a picture of a neuromuscular junction. Yeah, so here is a muscle fiber. You can see all the sarcomeres. Here is a nerve axon. Here's a little axon terminus, or axon terminal, or terminal button. And why is there a swelling at this axon terminus? Okay, because it's going to make a synapse. What's necessary? What components do you have to have in this axon terminus? You got to have neurotransmitters, because this synapse right here is what we call a chemical synapse. So remember, I think we learned that there are two kinds of synapses. There's electrical versus chemical. And if it's an electrical synapse, that just means that an electrical signal can hop directly from one cell to the next. But the neuromuscular junction does not allow that. There's a space between the cells. We call that the synaptic cleft, just like we did for a neuron-neuron synapse. So this swelling right here has factories for making ATP, namely the mitochondria, as well as synaptic vesicles that contain neurotransmitter. And at the neuromuscular junction, that neurotransmitter is always acetylcholine. So that's the signaling molecule that the neuron releases into the synaptic cleft. It diffuses across the synaptic cleft, and it binds to receptors in the postsynaptic membrane, in this particular case right here, right, that's going to be a muscle cell, and that causes the electrical signal to develop once again in the muscle. And the electrical signal will flow over the whole surface of the muscle, causing that muscle to contract. And even the electrical signal is going to go down this little membrane right here, which is what we call a transverse tubule or T-tubule, and that's going to cause release of calcium in all the myofibrils so that the myosin and actin filaments can start to slide over each other. That's just kind of a little recap of what we've talked about already. All right, so the signal for the docking and fusion of these synaptic vesicles to the presynaptic membrane is actually calcium. So when an electrical signal comes down an axon to the axon terminus, it allows for calcium to enter the synaptic terminus, and that's going to stimulate the release of acetylcholine from the axon terminal. Okay, so this is just another way of looking at synaptic transmission, and the ion that's important that actually signals the release of neurotransmitter is calcium. Right? So the only way that you can contract any muscle in your body is by having the proper level of calcium outside these cells. So every time you take a breath, that diaphragm gets a signal, okay, from a nerve, and that signal can only go across the neuromuscular junction if you have the proper levels of calcium in the extracellular fluid. So here's a second example of where do you think, another question I could ask you, where do you think it's more important to have the proper levels of calcium? At neuromuscular junctions, so that you can control skeletal muscles, or for instance in bones, to have strong bones. Both are important, but if you had to pick one, what would you rather be able to do? Breathe, for instance, or have really strong bones that won't fracture if you fall? Yeah, of course, breathing. And your body understands that, and so here's another reason why as we get older, right, we have a tendency to lose calcium for bones because your body has other real important functions for calcium. Okay. Motor unit. I think maybe I had that on the last test. Okay, at least a figure. A motor unit is composed of one motor neuron, all right, and that motor neuron is going to bifurcate and innervate a number of different muscle fibers. So one motor neuron could innervate maybe five individual muscle fibers, or it could actually innervate maybe 1,000 different individual muscle fibers. All right, so some motor units are small in places of your body where you want to have very fine control, very delicate control, for instance your lips and your mouth for articulation and breathing, and your hands, right? Other parts of your body, the motor units are very large where you're not doing a lot with them, for instance postural muscles in the back or leg muscles. Motor units are very, very large. Okay, let me look at a picture here. So here's a picture of a motor unit. And so we have motor unit number one, and we can see it innervating one, two fibers, very few. Motor unit number two over here is innervating what? One, two, three. So when there's a signal down motor unit number one, it's going to cause a greater force of contraction, basically what, 50% stronger than motor unit number one, because there are only two muscle fibers that are being innervated. So here we can see the neuromuscular junction. So the neuromuscular junction is very similar to the synapse. The big difference is when one neuron stimulates another neuron through a synapse, do those neurons move with respect to each other? Not really. You have an electrical signal in the presynaptic neuron, gets converted into a chemical signal through the synapse, gets reconverted into an electrical signal in the postsynaptic neuron, and it's basically all that happens, but the neurons don't move. At the neuromuscular junction, however, right, when an action potential or an electrical signal gets down to this axon terminus, causes release of acetylcholine, that causes another electrical signal to develop on that muscle, what happens to this muscle? It moves, right? All right, so it's going to have a tendency to pull away from its motor neuron. So really the only difference between the neuromuscular junction and a synapse is that there are extra components at the neuromuscular junction that kind of glue the axon terminus to the muscle, because it's only this area right here underneath the or within this neuromuscular junction that have receptors for acetylcholine. So if these axon endings moved over to this part of the muscle, it couldn't cause the stimulation of the muscle because there are no receptors for acetylcholine over here. All right, so there are special junctions to make sure that this axon terminus doesn't move from this part of the muscle fiber. All right, and those things make up what we call the motor end plate. The other thing about the neuromuscular junction is that every time there is an action potential at the neuromuscular junction, it's going to cause this muscle to contract. So if it's a healthy muscle, this muscle right here can never decide for its own whether it's going to contract, can never make up its mind. All right, that's not true for neurons. Some neurons will select what information gets passed and what information is blocked from being transmitted, but A muscle cell right here always contracts when it receives an electrical impulse from its motor neuron, which is a good thing, right? Because what kind of muscle is this? It's skeletal, which means it is voluntary. So for instance, if I were to tell skeletal muscles in my arm to pick up this bottle of water, right, that's what it should do. If the skeletal muscle could make up its own mind, say if I wanted to pick up that glass of water but my muscle said no, well, that wouldn't be very useful, right? So skeletal muscles just what? Follow the commands automatically, right, without thinking from the brain, okay, because it's voluntary. Okay, smooth muscle and glands have different kinds of junctions. We call these varicosities. So these are synapses or little neuromuscular junctions along the whole length of the axon, stimulating whole ranges of cells, so we don't have what we call or consider motor units for the autonomic nervous system. Yeah. Neuromuscular junctions, well, where do we have association neurons? They're in the central nervous system, sure. So the association neurons help decide what skeletal muscles should be activated or when they should be activated, maybe through a reflex. Okay, but the neuromuscular junction, once it's stimulated, it's going to cause that muscle to contract, no matter what. Motor unit is the motor neuron and all of the muscle fibers that belong to, that will be stimulated by that one motor neuron. That's going to be connected to an association neuron someplace. Yeah? So a neuromuscular junction is connected to an association neuron via what? The motor fiber. And that association neuron is going to be in the central nervous system. Okay? Okay, so sometimes your skeletal muscles contract without your voluntary control. When might that happen? For instance, when you stimulate a reflex. Like if somebody walked up to you and poked you with a pencil or a pen, right? Your body is going to move, right? Or, yeah, you might actually elbow them back or something without thinking too much. So reflexes can activate skeletal muscles. And you can inhibit that to some degree, I suppose, like the knee-jerk reflex, right? Have somebody ever hit your knee with a little rubber mallet and your leg twitched? You could probably inhibit that reflex if you thought long and hard enough about it. Okay, so the higher centers, other association neurons can inhibit these motor neurons. Okay, so these are what we call varicosities. So autonomic nerves going to smooth muscle and the heart have varicosities instead of axon terminals. But these varicosities have synaptic vesicles that release neurotransmitter on smooth muscles. And these neurotransmitters are different than acetylcholine. These neurotransmitters are norepinephrine. Okay, so different neurotransmitters are used in different parts of your body. All right, so I think when we've looked at spinal nerves already, the dorsal root and the ventral root. Okay, but let's start in the brain looking at nerves. And so the nerves that leave the brain that go to the periphery are what we call cranial nerves. And we also said how many are there already? There are 12, right? And you got to know that there's 12. You've got to know the names of the 12 and also some of their functions. All right, so some functions of cranial nerves, some are sensory, like for vision, touch and pain. It's cranial nerves number 1, 2, and 8 over here. These are purely sensory nerves. Now, when we were looking at spinal nerves, what part of a spinal nerve is going to be just purely sensory? Okay, it's actually going to be a root. That's a better way of asking. What root or which root is purely sensory? Okay, yeah, the dorsal root. Okay, the spinal nerve is always going to have both components. But that's not true for cranial nerves. 1, 2, and 8 are purely sensory. They don't have any motor component whatsoever to them. purely sensory or afferent. Some are purely motor, somatic motor, to skeletal muscle in the head and neck. All right, that's 3, 4, 6, 11, and 12. So that means, motor means what? Signals arising from your central nervous system going out to the periphery. We're going to learn how to talk about these different numbers in just a little bit. Okay, parasympathetic motor, that means that it is part of the autonomic nervous system. Right, and here are the cranial nerves that participate or have parasympathetic motor output. And probably the most important is number 10 over here. And number 10 we're going to see is called the vagus nerve. Right, so cranial nerve number 10 and vagus are the same thing. And it plays a very important role in the parasympathetic nervous system. So I'm going to talk some more about that in a little bit. And some cranial nerves are mixed. They have more than one function. They have both motor and sensory function. All right, now when it comes to cranial nerves, there are 12 of them. It can get a little confusing unless you're really good at memorizing, and I'm sure you guys are getting better at memorizing, but nonetheless, it's helpful to know little tricks to memorize things, right? And a little trick is what we call a mnemonic, okay? And there is a nice little website you can go to called medicalmnemonics.com, or you can Google mnemonics if you want to, and you can learn mnemonics for learning all kinds of things, biology or chemistry. And the useful thing about a mnemonic is that when you have a long list of things, like the 12 cranial nerves, the names of 12 cranial nerves can sometimes be a little incomprehensible just to memorize them. But if you turn it into a little poem or saying or a sentence, then it becomes a little bit easier to memorize that list, right? Okay, and so that's what a mnemonic is for. So here is a mnemonic for the 12 cranial nerves. So here is the number, here is the name, okay? And your book has a mnemonic as well, and you can find other mnemonics at that website. And if you need to write that down on a test, okay, that's fine. But if you go to medicalmnemonics.com, make sure you filter out the X-rated mnemonics, okay? Because I don't want to hear any X-rated mnemonics in class or in the hallways, all right? Because there's plenty of good PG-rated mnemonics. All right, so what are the cranial nerves? Let me show you how they are arranged first. Now, this can be a little intimidating when you see something, but it's really pretty easy, all right? So we're looking at the base of the brain, and what part of the brain is this compared to this by the cerebellum? This is the, this is the anterior part of the brain. Here is the posterior part of the brain. And as we move from anterior to posterior, that's how we give the cranial names their numbers. So the most anterior one is cranial nerve number 1. The next most anterior is cranial nerve number 2. And the next one is number 3. So knowing the location by number is actually fairly easy as long as you can count backwards from 1 to 12. There's a little jog when we get to the medulla over here, but it's not too hard. So this might be an exam figure, and that would be really good because it's easy to count, right? Number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, all the way down to number 12. All right, what might not be so easy to know is how the number corresponds to the name. Like the first one right here, well, this one is actually easy. This is the olfactory nerve. Because what's the most anterior part of your face? That's your nose, right? That's the sense of olfaction. What's another anterior part of your head? Your eyes. That's going to be cranial nerve number 2, right? Optic nerve, right up over here. And then we got the oculomotor nerve for controlling how your eyeballs move around inside your head. All right, so let's go back to the text slide. So here are the names of all the cranial nerves and the one function that I would like for you to know. Okay, so these cranial nerves, some of them have many different kinds of functions. But I don't want you to memorize every single one, but just what's on this list right here. All right, so this is just a select number of functions. So olfactory, is that easy? Yeah, that is what? That's just smell. Olfaction and smell are the same thing. Optic nerve is for vision. Oculomotor is for pupil constriction. Trochlear, eye motion. All right, and then we got the trigeminal abducens. All right, let's talk about this one just a little bit. Eye muscle, that goes to an eye muscle. What does it mean to abduct? I like to pick on this one quite a bit because it just kind of tells me a little bit about your overall familiarity. Abduction is what? Moving toward midline or away from midline? Away from midline, right? Adduct means to move toward midline. So since that's innervating an eye muscle, it's going to move your eye. Which way is it going to move your eye? Away from midline, okay? But not both eyes at the same time, obviously, okay? So the abducens works on one side of your body at a time, moving, causing a lateral rotation. And what did your mother always say? Oh, no, that's going the other way, yeah. I don't know if anybody, you can cross your eyes, you can adduct both eyes at the same time. And what did your mother say? Don't cross your eyes because they could get stuck sometime. I don't think that would ever happen, but anyway, the abducens, so you see the function of the abducens is actually pretty easy to appreciate. It's going to cause a lateral rotation of the eye. We'll look at some eye muscles when we get to the sensory chapter. So to learn this list right here, how many cranial nerves have a H in them?
One.
There's only one, and that's cranial nerve number 12. So that's another easy one to pick to see if you studied a little bit, right? So why is it easy? Because if you have a mnemonic right here, here's the mnemonic, on old Olympus's towering top, a Finn and German viewed a hop. All right, so what do people use hops for? It's not a dance.
Beer.
Beer, right? It's a grain that's used in making beer. And I guess Germans, people that live in Germany and people that live in Finland brew a lot of beer so that they can drink beer, right? It's a very nice adult beverage. So here is just a little saying that you can use, right, to memorize this list of cranial nerves. All right, so on stands for olfactory, old stands for optic, Olympus, right, is oculomotor. Now, what is this Olympus? Why is that apostrophe over there? That's a really huge mountain in Europe, right? It's a very outstanding mountain overlooking a bunch of farmland. So that's where towering top comes from. And A is for abducens, F for facial. And right here is for vestibulocochlear. Okay. Now, wait a second. Now, why is everybody laughing? Oh, well, you see, this cranial nerve number 8 used to be called the auditory nerve. So that's why the and is in there. But we've actually simplified the list a little bit. We've converted auditory to vestibulocochlear. And you'll see why that is actually a very nice simplification when we get into the next chapter. Okay, you'll appreciate why that is. Vestibular cochlear. Okay, but you could imagine this vestibular cochlear nerve has something to do with hearing, for instance. But we also know, or you have to know, that it has other functions as well. Okay. So in terms of cranial nerve function, there's another mnemonic. Remember I said some are motor, some are purely sensory, and some are mixed. So here is another little mnemonic that you can use to memorize what cranial nerves have which kind of functions. Some say money matters, but my brother says big bucks matter most. All right, so S stands for sensory, M stands for motor, and B means what? It is both sensory and motor. All right, so guess how many words there are in this sentence. There are 12 corresponding to the 12 cranial nerves, okay? Okay, so here are some sayings that you can say, well, yeah, the function of that cranial nerve is such and such. All right, so if you look over this a couple times, I don't think it will be too hard to understand the function and the names and the number of these cranial nerves. Yeah?
While I was reading about the cranial nerves.
Yeah? How do they get inflamed? You know, we think, and I don't know if there's very good evidence for this, we think it's viruses, we think it's a viral infection, and once a virus gets inside of a cell, we can't really get in there and measure to see if the virus is in there without taking the nerve out. Well, that person probably would like to keep their nerve right where it is, even though it's inflamed, right? So we can do some antibody tests in the serum to see if there are antibodies trying to fight that virus, but it's very difficult to fight that virus once it gets inside of a neuron, and even to tell if it's in that neuron, because it can become very dormant for a long period of time. Yeah. So like shingles would be a result of a herpes virus that's in a nerve, and it can be dormant for 50 years or something. Yeah. Okay. So by inference, we can sometimes diagnose. All right, so I don't think I have any other important spinal, cranial nerves to show you. No more pictures. All right, so let's move from cranial nerves to spinal nerves. Spinal nerves are all mixed, right? And because roots are either afferent or efferent, but roots come together to form a spinal nerve, so it's going to have both afferent and efferent components. The roots, they're medial to the spinal nerve, so a root is between the spinal nerve and the spinal cord. And they're either afferent or efferent. They're never mixed. Rami, on the other hand, right? Well, I guess I'm going to have to show you what a ramus is. I don't want to look at this. I want to look at, that's a pretty good figure. This one is maybe even better. But I'm going to have to zoom in. All right, so I zoomed into the spinal cord. I maybe can even zoom in over here. Ah, it's even better. All right, so we see a nice spinal cord, see gray matter, white matter. Here are the horns of the gray matter. What are these white areas right here? Yeah, it's white matter, which means it's axons. These are tracks either going up or down. But how do we talk about these parts of white matter right here? Okay, here are the roots. Here's a dorsal root. Here's the ventral. Dorsal means what? Posterior. There's that spinous process on a vertebrae. All right, but the white matter right here, okay, they're either called columns, that's an easy word to write down, or funiculus, they're tracts. So they're tracts, so there are many tracts in this area of the spinal cord. This would be the lateral column or lateral funiculus. This would be the posterior column or posterior funiculus, and this would be the anterior column or funiculus, right? And they're filled with tracts. All right, so here is a dorsal root. This is purely sensory. Here is the ventral root. That's purely motor. These come together as it's going out the intervertebral foramen, and it forms a spinal nerve. All right, but we see that spinal nerve bifurcates very quickly. Part of it is going to innervate areas that are posterior to the vertebral column. So this is what we call a ramus. And since it's going to the posterior part of your body, we call that the posterior ramus. Here is one that is going to course around, and this we're at the level of the thorax right here, because I would see like lungs in this region, so the nerves just can't cut right across through the lungs, but they have to go through the chest wall. This is a ramus, but it's not the posterior ramus, this is the anterior ramus. Yeah, lateral might be a good guess, but since it's going to everything anterior to the vertebral column, we call that the anterior ramus. Oh, ventral. Yeah, ventral ramus and dorsal. So dorsal ramus, yeah, so you could use either ventral or anterior. Okay. So this ramus is carrying both motor neurons as well as sensory neurons. So what's the function? What would we say the general function of this ventral ramus or anterior ramus is? It is mixed, right? It carries both kinds of traffic, both motor as well as sensory. So both rami, right, the dorsal and ventral ramus are mixed, but what about roots? Roots are either one or the other, but never mixed, right? They're either sensory or motor. So you should have a little idea in your mind. What's the difference between a root and a ramus? Ramus is always mixed. Root is going to be one or the other, okay? And you see where they are located at. Okay, what branch? Oh, look, I haven't read this question in a long time. Let's see if I know the answer. What branch of a spinal nerve carries afferent and efferent information to your erector spinae muscle? Ooh, okay, so let's start by thinking, where is the erector spinae at? Yeah, your back, right? So they are what? Extensors of the vertebral column. They're in your back. All right, so what branch of a spinal nerve carries... All right, so what goes back there? Does a root go back there or a ramus? It's a ramus. So which ramus? Dorsal ramus. And does a ramus carry both afferent and efferent information? Absolutely. So you would want to say what? Dorsal ramus. And you know what? This is a little trick because we haven't talked about that one yet, but in the next chapter we will. So it can't be root, right? Because those are just going to be sensory or motor. And it can't be the ventral ramus because that goes to the anterior part of your body. Erector spinae are posterior. So who saw how we kind of looked at that question right there? Is anybody kind of lost with this question? You actually have to think about a number of different components to see how why we answered it. Yeah. Ah, the actual nerve. Okay, a nerve is an organ. Okay, so a nerve has many thousands or tens of thousands of axons in it, and it has connective tissue, has different sheaths, and it has blood supply to it, has, so therefore it's really an organ. Okay, a ramus is, let's go back to the picture. All right, so a ramus right here is carrying everything that's going to this posterior compartment of the body. And when it starts to bifurcate, after this bifurcation, then we're going to call this thing a nerve. And we're going to call this thing a nerve. It's really no longer a ramus. Okay, and so we're just going to have to now start naming these nerves as they go to smaller and smaller parts of your body. So here is the ramus, and when it starts to bifurcate to go to different organs in your body, then we're going to call, we're going to name it a nerve. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So in this class, you have to know some nerves. I think in lab you have to know more nerves than you do for lecture. Okay. But here are two important nerves. The phrenic nerve arises from spinal nerves at the levels of C3, C4, and C5. All right, so let's go back to maybe this picture right here. So these are all these cranial nerves or spinal nerves or what? You know, I would say spinal nerves because they're arising from the spinal cord. All right, and now let's look at, all right, so here's the cervical region. C1 actually comes out between the occipital bone and the first cervical vertebrae. So it comes out superior to the first cervical vertebrae. So how many cervical nerves do we, how many cervical vertebrae do we have? Okay, remember you have breakfast at 7 and you have lunch at 12, right? So you got 7 cervical vertebrae. Now how come you don't have 7 cervical spinal nerves? Because the first one comes out between the occipital bone and C1. Okay, so you actually have 8 spinal nerves from the cervical region because you get one before you even find the first cervical vertebrae. Okay, so that's C1. All right, so here we see some nerves, and we see a network of nerves right over here. We're going to talk about that network in just a second. But we were talking about the phrenic nerve. Okay, and the phrenic nerve is real important. So here's C1, 2, 3. Phrenic nerve comes from here. It comes from 2. I mean from 4 and also from 5. Where's the phrenic nerve at? Ah, you know what? I think it's this one right here, but okay. What I really want you to, I'm going to have to maybe find a better picture. But what I want you to know is that the phrenic nerve comes from C3, 4, and 5. And you have to know where the phrenic nerve goes to. Let's see if I can find where the phrenic nerve is going to. Okay, I think this is probably a pretty good one. Okay. All right, zephrenic. Here's the phrenic nerve. All right, so it gets some innervation from C5. It has innervation from C4, and it also gets innervation from C3. And this nerve is going to course down from your neck. And what organ is it going to innervate? Okay, yeah, I haven't told you. I don't know why you would know that unless you have a little bit of background. But the phrenic nerve does go to the diaphragm. And what does the diaphragm do for us? It allows us to breathe. It allows us to inhale. All right, so here is the nerve that allows us to breathe, the phrenic nerve. So if this nerve here is damaged, what muscle doesn't know how to contract anymore? The diaphragm, because it's a voluntary muscle, right? So that's a very important nerve to know. And there's a little saying, all right, to help you memorize that it's these three origins that comprise the phrenic nerve, and that little saying is C3, 4, and 5 keeps you alive. Because without innervation from these nerves right here, of course, you can't breathe, and that's what happens to you. Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about a plexus right now. All right, so there are a number of different plexes in your body. I'm going to go back to this one right here. You have a cervical plexus. You have a brachial plexus, right? You got a lumbar plexus and a sacral plexus. All right, so what's the beauty of a plexus? Well, how many different ways do you know how to get to school in the morning? There's probably one preferred way that's the fastest, but I know I always listen to traffic reports on the way to work, because if there's a big accident on the 405 freeway, all right, then I know that I'm going to get stuck in traffic and I'm going to miss my anatomy class and get in trouble. So I might elect to take maybe the 91 freeway instead of the 405. So I can take a little excursion around that blockage if there's a SIG alert someplace. So I know a number of different ways how to get to my destination. So I can take alternate routes to get to someplace that's going to fill up my bank account, which is a good thing, right? Okay, so in this particular case, think of the diaphragm as being your bank account. How many different ways can signals get to the diaphragm to keep you alive? For instance, if there is a spinal cord injury, if it's at the level between C3 and C4 right here, the diaphragm can still receive signals from what? C3 and get to the diaphragm. So somebody can stay alive, right? So the beauty of a nerve plexus is that nerve signals can take alternate routes to get to very important organs in your body to maintain that function, that important function. So that's the beauty of a plexus, right, is that nerve signals can take alternate routes. So if there is damage to one part of the nervous system, there still is a way for that organ to receive information to still perform its function. All right, so the cervical plexus is important for generating signals that go through the phrenic nerve to get to the diaphragm. Another important plexus, or another important nerve is the sciatic nerve. It arises from spinal nerves L4 through S2. And I don't have a nice mnemonic to know that one, but maybe you guys could come up with one and share one with me. All right, and let's see if we can see where the sciatic nerve comes from. Where's the sciatic nerve come from? Okay, where's the sciatic nerve? Okay, so sciatic nerve is right here. That's coming from the sacral plexus. All right, so that's a big important nerve that innervates your whole lower appendage. So signals can take alternate routes, okay, to get to your lower appendage so that you don't lose that function of the lower appendage. Okay, so that's a plexus. You got to know where these plexes are located. You got to know the function of a plexus. And these are the two nerves that you have to be aware of and where they originate from. All right, so this is kind of like a little subset for what you have to know in lab. So that's it for peripheral nervous system. Next time, we're going to start autonomic nervous system. Okay, autonomic nervous system. And a good place to start for the autonomic nervous system is review that very first picture that we looked at today. The very first picture is this one right here. Just review this one. That's a somatic motor pathway.